Well, he likes fruit and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Did you hear his line the other week when we were babysitting one of that spaghetti?
He said he likes you less and less.
Okay. What?
She said I look like her.
Alexander was like.
All right, we're stuck.
And he's got all these black collars.
All the children need to come in.
No.
No, you should. There's a Braves fan walking through the aisle.
He's starting.
That guy, he had a Braves jersey. He looks like Swanson. And big thick calves.
Okay,
people were just yelling. And poor guy, he was walking through the aisle. He got it.
She's not a good husband.
I wouldn't wish that on anybody there.
Just like her.
I didn't realize, I forgot, you know, Nola's brother is the catcher for the
Baseball Hodges. Did you hear what I said?
He's a starting catcher.
Oh, yeah.
She stinks.
Yeah.
No.
I don't know. I've had a pretty good hugging.
Well, I went up to Leslie this morning and I went, Leslie.
She is amazing.
Oh, you're so cuddly. And she goes, and I go, no, I'm not going to compliment. Because I said, when I hug my daughter-in-law, she just goes, when? But Leslie kind of is all in. Bam! She's on top of you.
Because Leslie's all soft. Yeah, like she's so
happy. Okay, lads.
I'm generally talking in real. Still formulating my thoughts.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we're going to get started, and we'll begin with prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this Sabbath day. We thank you for the opportunity to learn from your word, to learn from history, to understand your providences. We thank you for a free country in which we can gather and do this, and we ask your blessing upon us in Jesus' name. Amen. I still can't hear out of my right ear, so I sound like I'm in the bottom of a well, and that's not a great thing.
You have a virus or something?
I don't know.
From last week.
It's something that's taken over my ears for some reason.
One's brain.
Over the last couple months. Let's start with
like my dad.
Passage from Psalm 78. First few verses. Listen, O my people, to my instruction. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not conceal them from their children, but tell to the generation to come the praises of the Lord, and his strength, and his wondrous works that he has done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should teach them to their children, that the generation to come might know, even the children yet to be born, that they may rise and tell them to their children, and that they should put their confidence in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. A multi-generational command from the words of Asaph in Psalm 78. Psalm 78 is the name of a publisher. Also, Psalm 78 Ministries, it's a Christian family in Florida. And I'll make reference to something that they've accomplished that's actually relevant to our class, perhaps a little bit later. We have been looking at a long Presbyterian, if you will, tradition within the church. And when last we met, we talked about the Waldenses and the followers of John Wycliffe, those who had his translation of the Bible, and they became known as Lollards. And the Lollards, when they were chased out of England, went to Scotland. And the reason that we know that the pure gospel was being preached in Scotland, which, by the way, was probably the most superstitious and priest-ridden country in Christendom. Amidst that, we have preaching of the gospel and the dissemination of the scriptures in English. Now, it wasn't the Scots kind of English. It wasn't a Lowland Scot language, but it was the language of Wycliffe and of England at the time, medieval England. But even before the Lollards came to Scotland, and the reason that I'm emphasizing Scotland is if you ask a church historian where Presbyterians come from, they'll say they come from Scotland because of John Knox and the Scots Presbyterians. And indeed, in terms of the relevance for ourselves in church history, Presbyterianism as a form of government, as well as a system of doctrinal belief and preaching, reached its apex in Scotland. And it's something that happened there virtually overnight in the entire country during the Reformation became Reformed. But it wasn't something that actually did happen overnight. There was a long tradition, although underground and under the radar, of gospel preaching in Scotland. It wasn't just the Lollards from the 13th century or the 14th century, but even prior to that, going back to perhaps even to apostolic times, when allegedly Andrew the Apostle or Saint Andrew came to Scotland in the first century. There had been an old church in Scotland known as the Chaldee Church, C-U-L-D-E-E, the Chaldees. And they were really an off-brand Catholic church, you might say. Of a friend who would call them an off-brand church. But they were the Britain Celtic Christian Church from the earliest days of Christendom in the British Isles. And while they disappear virtually in England, in Scotland, they build little stone churches in different places of Scotland. And they're really outside, in a way, they're outside the Roman Catholic Church. They're a Celtic Christian church, which adheres more to apostolic truth than the Roman Church becomes in the Middle Ages. Question?
Was this the gospel that was brought to Iona? That monk or whoever it was that brought the gospel?
Yeah. Yeah. This is the old Celtic church that was brought to Scotland through the missionaries of Iona, of the island of Iona. And brought by the monks called the Chaldees, or the Celtic worshippers of God. And they're found in the 7th century, in the 11th century, in the 15th century. It's probably the Chaldees that connected with the Lollards, as a matter of fact. But it was, in a way, it's pre-Reformation, but there's certainly some gospel preaching that was already there when the Lollards came and they connected. Another influence in Scotland in the pre-Reformation period, prior to the 16th century, the 1500s, were the followers of Jan Hus, who was a Czech reformer. And that's spelled C-Z-E-C-H, like Czechoslovakia used to be when it existed. But it was a particular tribe in Central Europe called the Czechs, and there was a priest there by the name of Jan Hus, whose years are 1373 to 1415. So he's an entire century before Martin Luther, and in an area known as Bohemia. And there he is preaching the gospel of grace, and it's very different from the kind of Roman Catholic religion that most of the priests and bishops are teaching. And some of his followers were called Hussites, came to Scotland because they were persecuted in Europe. In fact, the beginning, as it is with most reformers, it was true of Luther and Calvin also, Jan Hus, and even John Wycliffe, they were just considered church reformers, and church reformers were commonplace. There were monks traveling throughout Europe, throughout the whole history of the Christian church in Europe, who were actually preaching the gospel and were calling for reform in the church, because the church had become, at different periods of history, become more and more corrupt and had changed what people believed and what they said that the Bible taught. And the church divided on a number of occasions, what's known as the Great Schism, where they had two popes and then three popes in Europe, all claiming to be the vicar of Christ on earth. And especially during those times when there is a great amount of superstition and it's all mostly political differences within the church, those are times when reformers would rise up and say, this is not Christianity, and would try to return to the preaching of the gospel. But superstition certainly was rife during that period. And then along comes, in the 16th century, Martin Luther. And I'm going to presume that we know already a lot about Martin Luther. And I'm not going to spend much time on him. Printing presses came to Scotland in 1507. And that potentially is going to give printers, publishers, an opportunity to print things that are popular in Europe on the continent. And some of those popular things are being written by monks like Martin Luther. And Lutheran preaching and teaching is penetrating right into Scotland fairly quickly during Luther's early days as he's publishing sermons and some of his ideas. Now, Martin Luther is a German monk in Saxony, and he has been converted through reading the scriptures. He's an Augustinian monk, or an Austin. They were called Austin friars. Just Austin means Augustinians. And they studied St. Augustine, who was a church father back in the 4th century. And St. Augustine had written quite a number of things, and he's considered one of the greatest of the church fathers. And things that he taught were now being denied by some of the other church fathers, but the Augustinian monks loved St. Augustine, and so they read him. And when they read St. Augustine, they ended up studying books like the Book of Romans, for instance. Because St. Augustine taught predestination and salvation by grace. And he prayed to Mary. He was no proto-Protestant. But when it came to the Reformation, a lot of the things that St. Augustine had taught and preached were the very same doctrines that Martin Luther is going to teach and to preach also. And so in the early days of Luther, what he says is part and parcel of what's acceptable. It's within the boundaries of acceptable Christian doctrine, because the church, the Roman church, has never actually sat down and codified what they believe. So there are all sorts of beliefs throughout the church all over the place. And an Austin friar in Germany who is merely preaching what St. Augustine was preaching is not going to really come to the notice of the church fathers that disagree with him, at least initially. But eventually, with the preaching of the gospel and his personal conversion, he begins attacking specific things that bring money into the Catholic Church. You know, it's for Martin Luther, it's going to be one of those follow the money things, because there are a number of practices in the church that are designed just to bring money to flow it into Rome for the Pope to spend on his palace. And he lives in this magnificent palace with gold and diamonds and lavish clothing and furniture, and it's called St. Peter's Cathedral, and they're building it. It takes centuries to build. It's that magnificent. And it costs billions of dollars by today's money. Well, in order to get that money for the Pope to spend on his palace, he sent out monks around Europe to raise the money. And one of the things that he did that triggered Martin Luther's rebellion was the sale of indulgences. An indulgence means permission to do something. And what they were selling was permission to sin. People wanted to be able to continue their sinful lives, and they could actually purchase time off in purgatory by buying an indulgence. Or they could buy an indulgence for some of their dead relatives. Like grandma who died last year, she's suffering the agonies of purgatory, and you can knock 1,000 years off the time she has to spend in purgatory, which they also invented, by spending a certain amount of money and giving it to the papal representative. And so they would stand in the middle of a town and they would read the latest indulgence from the Pope, and people would come and give their, the poor people would give their last dollar to try and ease the pain of a dead relative, or to purchase forgiveness of sins so that they could go on and sin. They could purchase an indulgence for their particular sinful activities.
It reminds me when I worked at Armstrong World Industries years ago when I was single. I told you we went to Wendy and Chris, good friends, we went to the Catholic Church with them anyway. Wendy's still following the Lord, but anyway, Chris, she'd come in on Monday morning and tell me, Friday night, she hooked up with some guy, went to a hotel and slept with him. And I go, Chris, you know, you shouldn't be doing that, because she had accepted the Lord. She goes, I know, but she goes, I got up Saturday morning and went to confession.
Oh. Right.
And I remember thinking, oh man.
And the priest forgave my sins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, wow, I go, Chris, you have a lot to learn.
So Martin Luther, who was not just a scholar, not just a doctor of the church, was also a pastor. He pastored the church at Wittenberg, and so he had all these students, and that kind of stuff drove him crazy, because he knew it was all part of this system, and it was, he couldn't find it in the scriptures anywhere. And he attacked it. And he attacked the sale of indulgences and told people to save their money. Don't give it to the Pope. You're crazy. It's illegal and it's immoral. So don't do it. And all of a sudden, the guys who sold the indulgences weren't, they called it milking the German cow. That's what the Pope called it. It's time to go milk the German cow some more. Go sell some more indulgences and phony permission slips for sinning, so we can build this magnificent palace for the Pope. And so Martin Luther rebelled against that, and he cost them money. And that's when they took notice of him, is suddenly the cow stopped giving milk. In Saxony, and you know, throughout the Reformation, there is a very close connection between the Church and the Holy Roman Emperor, who was neither holy nor Roman, nor an emperor. But that's what he's called, and he's sort of over all the princes in Germany, but they elect him to be the Holy Roman Emperor. And he's always in competition with the Pope for money, taxes.
And he's still part of the Catholic Church.
And political power, yes.
He was part of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, he is. He is. He's over all of the German princes, and they're all Catholic, of course, part of Christendom. But he's trying to get money too, and secure his position as the elector, as the man elected to be Holy Roman Emperor. Wants it to pass it on to his children, but the electors would have to elect him and all that stuff. So he has to keep the German princes happy. But he also wants to keep the Pope happy, but not too happy. And so there are all these interlocking competitive power plays within the civil government as well as the church government. And then under all of this, you have monks that are coming to faith in Christ and saying, returning to the Bible and saying we need to return to the New Testament church. And these protests break out all over the place. And so now the Reformation is gone beyond an intellectual exercise by doctors of the church, by the theologians. Now, the Reformation is, in essence, something that God used the educated theologians to preach the gospel. So while the common man was hearing the gospel for the first time, being expounded from the pulpits, and then they're being converted, it's really the educated elites who are behind the Protestant Reformation. It's not from the ground up.
Would that be because they're the ones that could actually read?
Oh yeah,
understand it?
They're the only ones that are educated. They're the only ones that are educated, and
not hearing it from anywhere else.
And they're all within the folds of the church.
Yeah.
But as they become, there's another factor here that's allowing this to happen, because now it's called the High Middle Ages, is the Renaissance. There's been a renewed interest by scholars and scholarship in the ancient Greeks and Romans. And so they're going back and they're rereading and trying to discover more of the wisdom of the ancients. Not scripture, per se, but ancient Rome and ancient Greece, which is pagan. And there's sort of become an enlightened sense that the more you know about the ancients, the smarter you'll be, the better off you'll be, and it will actually help the church. And so there's a new openness toward thinking outside the demands, the box that everybody's been put in by the popes and the cardinals and the church.
Bill,
and so
two questions.
Yeah.
One is this almost taxation.
It did.
Interesting. And was there, am I hearing that there's a loose network of gospel believers, as Martin Luther was. It wasn't just Martin Luther, I anticipate. It sounds like you're saying there's others that were.
There are others in right. Different, like the Waldenses, for instance, in the mountains of the Piedmont. As the Reformation proceeds, they come in contact with the Protestant Reformation, and this is what we've been preaching for 400 years. And they become part of the Reformation. So the Waldenses kind of disappear from history, but they're absorbed into the Protestant Reformation. So there are these networks like that, and the Lollards in English-speaking countries, and people like Jan Hus and the Hussites, they have connections in some of the other German states. And so there are these networks already, but along comes men of great scholarship and erudition, like Martin Luther, and he starts a wildfire that races through Germany. Now, in the end, the Catholic Church and the Catholic monarchs are going to go to war, I mean real war, against the Protestant Reformation. And there's going to be a war that lasts 100 years. There's going to be a war that lasts 80 years. The war for the Dutch Republic. There's going to be the 30 Years' War, which is going to be the most destructive war in history in Europe. 30 Years' War is going to kill millions of people. And it's going to start out as Protestants against Catholics within the German states. And it's going to eventually absorb France. And England's going to get involved, and et cetera. So the mixture of Catholicism and the political states, the kings who are seeking to keep their positions in their territories, it's all going to come mixed up into these horrendous wars that have religious significance as well as international political significance. But the preaching of the gospel is going to go forward like wildfire. And in Germany, they're eventually going to settle the issues by Protestant and Catholic leaders meeting and coming to an agreement. And the agreement, the Peace of Augsburg, is going to say that, and there are hundreds of German states, there is no Germany, no such thing. There's no such thing as Germany until the 1870s. There are the Germanies, and most of them are city-states. Some of them are bigger than that, like Saxony. It's not a city, it's a provincial. But within all the German provinces, there are city-states. So there may be 300 different independent jurisdictions where they speak German. And over them all is supposed to be the Holy Roman Emperor. But he doesn't have control of very much when it comes right down to it. It's the local princes that do. So when they finally get through slaughtering each other for a number of years, they get together and say, we'll do it this way. Whatever way your prince goes, if he wants to be a Lutheran, or if he wants to remain in Mother Church, everybody in that state will have to go along with it. And it's how they finally settle it.
Is it like the governor, or like what kind of area?
Well, like Saxony, for instance. Frederick of Saxony is, Frederick the Wise is Luther's prince. Frederick the Wise is a Catholic's Catholic, and he collects relics. And of course, that's the first thing to go. When the Reformation begins to increase in Saxony, holy relics are one of the things that's got to go. And he's a collector. He has the finest collection of, he's got more saints' fingers and toes in his collection than anybody. You know, he's got 50 nails from the true cross, and a thorn from the crown of Christ, and I mean, he's got all these things in his reliquary. And eventually, he has to come to the understanding that, no, these things are not holy objects that have powers. So a lot of the superstition that goes with the Catholic Church is attacked by the reformers. And not all the reformers are the same. They disagree on all sorts of things. And that's one of the great criticisms of Protestantism by the Catholic Church, is that every Protestant is an anarchist. He gets to decide what the scripture teach. The church doesn't. The church has been withdrawn from his order of authority, and he's become his own sovereign. And so you've got all these different Protestant thinkers that have different ideas, and it is a problem. It definitely is a problem. And Luther is such a personality. It's his way or the highway. And so Germans that don't follow Luther, he attacks them viciously. And some of the Protestant reformers are reprobates. I mean, they've gone the whole way. They have become real anarchists. And they've abandoned the scriptures altogether and have just become, in a way, terrorists. So bad are the Anabaptists, and I can't say that too loud in Harrisonburg, because Harrisonburg's run by Anabaptists, Mennonites. I'm not saying the Mennonites, don't get me wrong, but the Anabaptists from which the Mennonites spring, some of them are radical, radical people. And they take over a couple cities in Germany. And the result is that the Catholics and Lutherans call time out from their war against each other, and they unite to destroy the Anabaptists. I mean, that's how bad it gets.
What was that called?
Oh, I don't remember if it has a particular name or not, but it's the Anabaptists have taken over the city of Munster, and they have a couple leaders. It's all based on guys that are there in charge, and they've declared that marriage isn't biblical. And so they declare a city open for free love, and that breaks the camel's back. The Lutherans and the Catholics join together, and they exterminate the people of Munster in Germany, which is a big city, walled city state. And then they can go back to killing each other later on. But so there's a far left wing in the Reformation and everything in between. But we are trying to concentrate, since I've followed a rabbit trail off into the distance. We're trying to concentrate on Scotland for now.
Presbyterian tradition.
What?
You're trying to concentrate on Presbyterian tradition.
Yeah, I am. So, as I said, almost overnight, the Reformation took root in Scotland. And it's because, I think, that there was a lot of groundwork laid through the centuries, although it wasn't immediately obvious. The Catholic Church spent a lot of time and money trying to locate real Christians in Scotland so they could burn them to death. And they certainly succeeded. And that's how we know about the Lollards in Scotland, is from their trials. I mentioned that earlier, because the only written records from the Middle Ages are church-related records from the Catholic Church. All right. The Reformation in Scotland really begins with two men, primarily. And the first one is Patrick Hamilton. Now, if you have that copy of this document that I gave to every family, John Knox and the Scottish Covenanters, Patrick Hamilton appears on page 9. And he was a young scholar at St. Andrews University in St. Andrews. He probably played golf, even. Mm-hmm. All those guys did. Believe it or not, as you might expect. St. Andrews' famous golf course is there. And it's interesting, John Knox played golf. Anyway, they were at the university, and Patrick Hamilton was this brilliant young theologian, a teacher at the university. And he was so exceptional that the university sent him to Paris to study. And he ended up going also to Strasbourg, which had become a Protestant Reformed city. And the more he learned on the mainland, especially in France, he read Luther's sermons. And Martin Luther had really taken Europe by storm as far as the printing press having published everything that he said and wrote. And it was coming into the hands of Renaissance scholars. Now, the foremost Renaissance scholar in Europe is a man named Erasmus of Rotterdam. He's a Dutchman. He's a genius. He's a huge critic of the Catholic Church and the papacy. But he never leaves the church. In his whole life, he becomes the most important, one of the most important figures of the Reformation, but he never becomes a Protestant. But he triggers a lot of scholarship, and his debates with Martin Luther become legendary. And in fact, when Luther was asked at the end of his life if anything he produced should be passed on to future generations, he said only two things that he did should survive him. And one was his translation of the Bible into German, and the other was the publication of his debates with Erasmus on man's will. It's called The Bondage of the Will, is the title of his book. It's never been out of print, and it has survived him as one of the most important written works that came out of the Protestant Reformation, called Bondage of the Will. It is a wonderful book. But it was a debate between Martin Luther and Erasmus of Rotterdam. And when Hamilton came from Scotland, he read Erasmus, which piqued his academic interest, and he took it further and began reading Martin Luther and became convinced of the importance of the gospel. And so Patrick Hamilton came back to St. Andrews and had quite an influence on his students, and he attacked the abuses of the church. And some of the doctrines that he attacked in his classroom at the university, he said there's no such thing as purgatory. It's not in the Bible. Well, that goes right, there's a cathedral at St. Andrews. There's a castle, there's a cathedral, and there's a university. So it's an important city in Scotland. And the cathedral is run by Archbishop Beaton, B-E-A-T-O-N. And he has Hamilton arrested because he teaches there's no purgatory. And that, of course, goes right, because the cathedral has in the altar of the cathedral a bunch of relics. Catholics from all over Europe come there to worship the relics that are buried in the altar in the cathedral. And they pay money to do it. And so the Archbishop's wealth comes from pilgrims coming to adore the relics. And here's a professor across the street saying that there is no purgatory, so there goes the indulgences. And that relics, huh?
In Rome?
No, it's St. Andrews. And that that relics have no powers. People come there to be healed. They believe the relics will heal them. They're told that the index finger of St. Andrews is one of the relics that's inside the altar of the cathedral. And so people come to bow before the little jeweled sarcophagus of St. Andrew's finger. Nobody ever actually checked, I'm sure. They couldn't get that close. But, you know, people claim to have been healed by that. And so people come, they pay money, and they get to touch the box of the relic or pray. And so Professor Hamilton is saying that's superstition, and purgatory doesn't exist, and the Pope is the Antichrist. Oh, that's a beaut. That doesn't go over well at all. Never has. And then he preaches that nobody is saved except those who are predestined by God to be saved. And that's it. Cardinal Beaton declares that Patrick Hamilton is a heretic, and he sends the soldiers. They grab the professor, they tie him to a post. The students think that it's a joke. They think that somebody's pulling a fast one on Dr. Hamilton. And then they pile up all the wood against the post, and they set it on fire. And so he preaches to the students. He knows he's being, it's an auto da fe. He is being burned at the stake. And he preaches the gospel to his students while the smoke is curling up and they burn him alive. He's 24 years old. So he's not that much older than some of his students.
Bill, can I ask a question there?
Yeah.
So this Beaton, is that right? That's his name?
Yeah.
You call him Captain Beaton, but in here it says Archbishop.
He's Archbishop. He's Archbishop Beaton.
So is he in the Catholic Church, or is he in one of these churches?
He's the Archbishop of the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And
so he has the authority to execute somebody.
He does have the authority to execute.
So somewhere and he's a government official as well.
He has the power to get rid of heretics.
Sounds like trying to wrap my head around so, that whole thing.
Bill, is it correct to say at this point in history, the church is more powerful than the government?
It is in some places. In some places, the church is more powerful than the civil authorities. But the civil authorities always are going to do what the archbishop wants. This guy is, Archbishop Beaton is...
But they were called kingmakers, correct? I mean, the popes, I mean, they're the ones that kind of controlled the governments.
Yeah.
Even if they weren't directly involved in the government, they're going to be listened to very heavily.
Right. Nothing happened without their consent. In a lot of places. Not everywhere. Mm-hmm. Some places, the prince is more powerful than the bishop. It just depends on where you are. There's a great deal of superstition in Scotland, and the church has overwhelming power.
Is this a good time? I mean, it's almost 10 till.
Yeah.
Is this a good time to ask a question?
Ask a question. I'm going to stop there. We'll start with George Wishart next week.
Who would you say of our contemporaries will be somebody that is going to be written up who has stood against the these things, these heresies in the church? Like, say, 300 years from now, who that we know...
Who in our generation or in the late 20th century...
Like Doug Wilson...
Kanye West.
Probably no one. Probably
Joel
no
Warcraft.
One. No, probably nobody.
Beaver?
Well, maybe Ryan, but...
Bill, you're probably thinking of also having a big sphere of influence as well.
See, we just don't...
Parts of that question, I think.
We just don't know. We really don't know. You could probably do a study of how often a person's name is mentioned in the
Google
mass media. Somebody like John MacArthur, for instance.
Okay.
I think we all thought Francis Schaeffer probably, but I don't think so. Rush Dooney's more important than Francis Schaeffer.
But Francis Schaeffer started it.
He was outspoken and he got media attention. He made films. He wrote books. The evangelical world paid attention to him, and so did the non-evangelical world paid attention to him. I don't think any of the popes in our lifetime are going to have any mention except John Paul II. In the Catholic Church, he's going to be important in the future when they look back over the period. But he's the only one that will.
Because of why?
The implementation of Vatican II, and the fact that under his rule, the Catholic Church had a resurgence in the latter part of the 20th century. All things considered, though, he was just a brief stopgap in the decline of the Roman Church. It's still going like this.
Something specific. I can't grasp anything.
She wants an answer to her question.
No, I'm saying why him?
just because he is the one that is most quoted, and people in the Catholic Church pray to him more than all the others. He's been dead for years.
He didn't fight heresy.
No, he's the Antichrist. Why would he do that?
We won't
worry about him. He's not going to turn up in any of our stuff.
So. Stood up for the truth. Yeah. Somebody that we can.
I jumped this off. He had mentioned his name, and I said, "Why would he be remembered?" But not for positive.
Next week's John Knox and John Calvin. I promise. They were the ones for today, but we didn't get there.
Thanks, Bill.
I love the way Ashley goes.
Yeah, I do too.
Hey, I was going to ask you a question. What does Christendom mean?
It means all of the people, all the people in the world who call themselves Christians.
Okay.
So it's a big, broad thing.
Right.
And it includes anybody who considers themselves Christians.
Okay.
So there are going to be many definitions of what that means, but when we talk about the Middle Ages and the Reformation and we talk about Christendom, we're actually talking about Protestants and Catholics.
Right.
Because they all, and the Eastern Orthodox churches, they're all part of Christendom. Okay. It doesn't mean Christian, they're not necessarily real Christians, but they think they are. They consider themselves Christian because there are different definitions of what that means. So it's a big, broad thing that kind of encapsulates Europe at this particular time that we're talking about.
Is Christendom and the visible church the same thing, Bill?
What's that?
Would you consider Christendom and the visible church the same thing? Because some people.
Yes, in a way. I guess you could say that.
You know what I mean?
I guess you could say that. In a way.
I guess you have to kind of. Depends on what you mean by it and how you nuance it. You know, visibly, the broader, church.
Because if you don't consider Catholics Christians, then you could consider them in Christendom, but not the visible church. That's why.
Per se. Yeah. I would.
Paul's response is pretty good. He said anyone that considers himself Christian.
Right.
Right. That's
sure. I like that.
Right.
That's
kind of the way Christendom is looked at.
I mean, it doesn't mean that.
But at the same time, we want to be careful because sometimes we would talk about the visible church as those churches that preach the gospel, including their children.
Real Christians.
And it would not include like Eastern Orthodox.
Right.
So I think it's what you mean when you say it.
Right.
But Christendom is
Christendom.
It is.
Christendom always embraces all those who think they're a Christian.
Yeah.
Okay.
Winston, it was really
right.
High.
Winston, visible church, though. We would define that as real Christians.
I understand you say that. I knew they worked back. They worked forward as well. Yeah. So I can prepay my indulgence.
Like you're saying you're watching
what should
right.
I do?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
He had a fever for 4 days.
And being a Catholic would be easy.
It works both ways.
Yeah. Horrible cold.
You just go ahead and buy it, do what you want,
just the chills and
come back,
the
buy some
thing.
More.
Yeah.
Milk the German cow.
Milk the German cow.
Yeah.
I mean, he's, I feel like I need to.
Thank you, Bill.
You're welcome.
I can get that back from
you. Oh, yes. And I will be, Lord willing, I'll be here next week.
Okay, very good.
My history
Two
tour
weeks in
is
a row.
Virginia.
Okay.
So we're wondering.
Was it just that his influence died with him, or was it something occurred?
No,
in his
I don't
life?
Think it did.
Okay.
I just think. Long run.
But he won't
I'm
be.
I'm thinking 100 years, 300 years from now. He's a
player. The way you phrased it, I was like, was it?
Because in the end, his influence was not.
Oh, gotcha.
I mean, it is what certain people.
But as a movement. With his favorite.